Welcome to the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, where you get multifamily investing made real. Learn from top players in the real estate investment world as they share their secrets with you and discover proven strategies on apartment investing that actually work. To learn more about Wheelbarrow Profits, visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. Now to your hosts, Jake and Gino.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Stenziano, host of the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father of six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbo. Gino, how's it going?
Always making it happen, big man. I got a term of the day here. What's the term of the day?
Come on, man. You're stealing this from me here. I sent it over to you.
Blue-collar work ethic, huh? Go get you some, huh?
That's right. It's just, you know, I think it's something that we miss at times. And I was just having maybe some self-reflection, today before I sent this over to you. And it's just like, guys, blue collar work ethic. Let's not forget that. That's where, you know, you get out there, you grind it out and get it done. So term of the day, blue collar work ethic. Next week, term of the day, probably still going to be blue collar work ethic, but we're going to see where it goes. So I just had to throw that out there. Guys, this is where we would normally plug something to pay the bills. Now for our listeners, we only showcase products and services that we approve or use in our own business. This time we're going to tell you about something of ours, specifically our Wheelbarrow Profits community. G-Dad, take it away.
Mr. Stenziano, as you know, we've been working really hard at growing the community. We're looking for like-minded investors, and we've gotten some pretty amazing results. We're looking to grow this amazing group. What we're looking for is those who want to follow the proven framework that we've created, the buy right, the manage right, and the finance right, hence that Wheelbarrow Profits. We want to leverage our connections and our education and, you know, the mentorship that we have as ways to take your business to the next level.
So guys, interested in finding out more about how you can become a part of our amazing community, apply to work with us at jakeandgino.com/apply. Enough shameless plugging. Gino, let's get to the show. Today's guest is Andrew Cushman. In 2007, Andrew left his corporate position to start investing in real estate. Starting off with single family properties, Andrew completed 24 single family transactions, which all made him and his investors money. In 2010, he transitioned to multifamily acquisitions and has successfully syndicated and repositioned 1,646 multifamily units. It's really great. So without further ado, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Hey, tell us about the corporate grind and the soul-sucking life that you had before real estate and why you transitioned.
Yeah, I took the standard path into real estate and went and got a chemical engineering degree.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, and candidly, my job was really good. It was pretty comfortable. I had a, you know, management position, so I was managing people. I wasn't out on the plant, you know, in the plant grinding away and sweating all day long. But it was certainly your typical corporate job where you've got, you know, countless layers above and the usual bureaucracy that goes with that. And you know, but it paid well, it was comfortable, but my wife and I both wanted something more. We wanted to be able to have our own business, kind of be able to achieve financial freedom. And we knew that the corporate route for us wasn't going to achieve that. And it took us a good 7 years to figure out that real estate was that path for us. And that's, you know, we first discovered flipping homes. We did that full time for like 4.5 years and then went into multifamily after that.
Andrew, you know, growing up as a child, I liked firefighting. I liked policemen. How did you grow up and say, I want to become a chemical engineer? How did you get down that path?
Well, I also liked fire as a kid, but okay.
And it's Beavis and Butthead, you must be like. Okay.
So we have a saying is mechanical engineers build things, chemical engineers blow them up, right? Okay. So as a kid, I would get the chemistry sets and then throw away the instructions and do my own stuff. I just found chemistry interesting. I found problem solving and math interesting. And so chemical engineering was those two things put together. And that's actually the piece that translated really well to real estate. And especially doing value add and repositioning is problem solving, finding something with problems and figuring out how to solve it. And then, of course, all the financial analysis in that part. So believe it or not, the engineering was actually a pretty good basis for real estate.
So, Andrew, how help me pitch engineers, because I know engineers are analytical to death. They really can't get out of their own way with the analysis paralysis. I've got a lot of guys who need to join our community, right? And I'm just saying this frankly. They get in in their own way, in spite of themselves, they're such smart guys. What would you say to them? They're looking to get into real estate. They're looking to get into some type of mentorship. What would you say? Guys, take the leap. I mean, it's enough with the analysis paralysis. You're smart enough. Let's take the next level. Let's take the next step.
Yeah, I mean, if analysis paralysis, I mean, it gets down to fear, you know, fear of making mistakes. And you have to just realize that no matter what happens, you are going to make mistakes, right? It's human nature. You know, you can look at Chernobyl or the Hindenburg or almost any Nicolas Cage movie. Mistakes are going to happen, right? And the key is when you make a mistake, learn from it, make a system so that you don't make that mistake again, and then keep going. So number one, just, you know, get past the analysis and don't fear making a mistake because it's just going to happen. The other thing to do also is partner with somebody who has a complementary set of personality traits, right? So if you're deep analysis, maybe partner with somebody who's more just get it done and do the analysis later, right? You don't necessarily want to do that, but the two of you can balance each other out. That person can, whether it's a mentor or just a literal partner, that person can help you get over the fear and get off the fence and actually do a deal, because you're not an investor until you actually do some kind of deal.
And what, ooh,
I like that.
Yeah, what he's saying out there, everybody, is find an accountability partner, whether it's a community like Jake and Gino or somebody else, get on the call with them and have somebody push you, because all the analysis at the end of the day is great. But if you don't take that action, what is it, Jake? Knowledge plus action equals power. All the knowledge in the world ain't going to give you no power. You got to take that action. So
Hold on. He just said you're not an investor until you get a deal done. That is power right there.
That's right.
Wow, man. Take that back, huh?
That's right.
Until you take some form of, until you either do a deal or an invest in a deal, until you've taken some kind of action, you're not an investor.
And Jake, the other thing I've heard is making mistakes is good, because Nicolas Cage has made a lot of mistakes. He's made a ton of money, I guess, right?
He's still got that money.
I mean, I wish I could make those kinds of mistakes, bro. I'm telling you.
Hey, I like the National Treasure movies.
I was just going to say, I like a few of his movies.
The Rock was a great movie, too, but you could also argue that was a Sean Connery movie, not a Nicolas Cage movie.
What was the point in your life when you said to yourself, enough with the chemical engineering? There's always that, you know, that seminal moment in your life. What do you attribute that to?
You know what? Actually, it was in high school. At the point I decided to become a chemical engineer, I knew that's not what I truly wanted to do. It was just a placeholder that I figured I could tolerate and have a decent income until I figured out what I really wanted to do. So I went into chemical engineering knowing I wanted to do something else. I just didn't know what it was yet. And I guess I've been working for, I don't know, 6.5-7 years. I saw a Wall Street Journal article about flipping houses. On the break room table, someone had left it there, picked it up, read it, took it home. My wife read it, and we said, you know what, we can do this. We'd done all kinds of other little businesses. Like, we looked into vending and making popcorn and all kinds of crazy things. And we're like, okay, these will make us a little bit of money and or become another job, but it won't get financial freedom. And when we looked at the flipping houses thing, we said, this we can do, and this has the potential to get us free. And it did.
So let me ask you, did you take any business classes? Would you recommend people taking business classes on top of your chemical engineering degree, or just say, you know what, just go full steam ahead?
I think for most people, that would slow you down and divert you from the path. I'd just jump into learning real estate.
Read some books. You're going to get there a lot quicker and save a lot of money.
I mean, especially if you're going into real estate, you can get basically the equivalent of a university education by listening to podcasts and watching YouTube and reading books nowadays. I mean, the opportunity to gain knowledge on your own is just amazing.
You're not getting this in college, because I'm going to extract some stuff out of it.
That's true.
You're gonna get some value, so you ain't getting that in college, I'm going to tell you right now.
So how did you get into your first deal? I mean, and why single family homes, and why flipping specifically?
It wasn't part of a grand plan. It was just the first thing that we found that we thought, you know, really thought could achieve what we wanted to. I would love to have gotten into multifamily earlier, but what happened is, you know, we found flipping houses, and we went into doing pre-foreclosures, which is calling people who, you know, getting in touch with people who are delinquent on their loan, but the bank hasn't taken it yet. They're getting ready to, right? And so, you know, I was a chemical engineer. I wasn't good at talking on the phone. My wife, I found this out later after we got married, but when we were dating, she would like write down lists of conversation topics so that when she'd call me, we could actually, you know, have a real conversation, because I was just, you know, wasn't good on the phone. And so then what did I do? I went into a business that relied on cold calling people who are in financial distress. Right. And that's not usually a fun conversation when you call up a stranger and say, hi, you've never talked to me before, but let's talk about your financial problems. Right. I mean, they're not generally happy to talk to you. So it took me 4,576 phone calls to get my first deal, 6 months.
There's the engineer.
Yeah, exactly. No, metrics, right? I counted it. So that first deal, we got it the day before he was going to lose it to the bank, and we bought it subject to the existing mortgage, you know, put like $19,000 worth of renovation into it, and then sold it. And we made as much as I made all year at my job. And so we said, that's it. I'm out. You know, I went in, quit. And I mean, I gave him about a month's warning and then left. Nice. Kept doing deals. 2 years later, my wife quit, joined full time. And then, we had a really good year in 2009, 2010. And we were like, okay, but equity's disappearing. This competition's getting higher. This isn't going to go forever. What's the next big thing? Where are all these people going, right? Well, they're moving into apartments and they're not going to be able to buy a house for 5 or 7 years. And when we come out of a recession, apartments typically do well. So we figured there were multiple factors pointing to a boom in apartments. So in 2011, we hired a mentor to learn apartments and bought our first one in 2011 and have been doing them full time since.
What was that first deal look like when you bought it?
The first apartment deal?
Mm-hmm.
It was the type of deal that I would never recommend anyone else do as their first deal. despite being an engineer having the tendency to analyze a lot, our naivety got us to just go ahead and take the jump into it. It was a 92-unit, 75% vacant property in Macon, Georgia, which is like 2,700 miles from where we live. And it was... I had been mismanaged for like 15 years, and we bought it all cash because there's no way it was going to get financed, but we didn't have the money. So we syndicated that deal and got it closed. And, you know, there's a lot of learning lessons on that. When you buy a property that was, you know, built in the 60s and 70s. And
dude, you're my hero. You got a fully vacant apartment deal on your first one that big, like, wow.
And raise money, bro.
Wow.
And,
yeah. But it probably took 2 years off my life though. So.
Wow. Yeah, but it gave you 2 years back in financial freedom.
That's a good point. Good point. Okay.
Let me ask you, how did you raise the money on that deal? Because everyone's always, their biggest block to multifamily investing is finding the deal, but even more, where do I get the money from? So how did you raise the money on that first deal?
Well, and one word of encouragement to everybody today in this market, mm-hmm. it's far harder to get the deal than the money. So if you get a great deal now, someone will help you with the money. But back then, a lot of people, it was still the recession. It was, things were a little bit tough. You know, we started with the usual friends and family. And then we also talked to the various investors we had used in the flipping business. So like we'd buy a house and then just go to someone and say, hey, give us, we'll give you 10% or whatever. And, flip the house, and then they get the points and the interest. So we had some investors from that. And then, our mentor actually saved our butt. He brought in some investors. And then what happened is one of our investors actually brought in several of his friends, and that finished it. That basically finished it off. And then also during the escrow process, we went to the seller and said, hey, look, this property's got a lot more rehab than we initially thought. We're not going to retrade, but we want you to carry a note for 2 years. And he agreed to that. So we had to raise $1.2 million. He carried a note for a couple hundred thousand, and the rest was syndicated cash.
And what attracted you to Macon, Georgia, and what attracted you to this deal specifically?
There looked to be a ton of upside on it. And also we wanted to do properties that were about 100 units because we were investing far away from home, properties that size will support on-site staff and are a lot easier to manage and have efficiencies of scale. So we wanted something about that size. As far as Macon, Georgia goes, candidly, what we did is, I don't use LoopNet for deals anymore, but back then it had a map feature. So we just started in Atlanta and we would just follow the freeways out and figure out what broker had the most listings in each town. And then we get in touch with that broker and start, you know, talk to them and look at deals and form relationships. And so that broker in that town who had about 70% of the listings at that time brought it to us. And, you know, it made sense that there was just a ton of upside to this thing.
What was the unit mix?
Oh, geez. It was, I think it was like 70, around 70 or so two-bedroom townhome style units. Oh, wow. And then the rest were two-bedroom flats.
I'm like drooling over this thing.
How long did it take you to find his deal? I mean, like when you first started looking, how long did it take you to find a deal like this?
Until we found that deal, we were still running the flipping business, mm-hmm. mostly full-time. So part-time, it took 6 months to get it.
6 months, guys. So he's in the business, he's doing flipping, and in the time where there were deals out there, it took him 6 months to find a deal. So it doesn't happen overnight. 4,500 calls, it doesn't happen overnight, right? That's what people come in, they think they're going to, you know, start investing and find a deal right away. There's a lot of legwork involved. Do you remember the numbers, what you bought it for? I mean, and what did you end up doing with this property? Did you end up selling it, refinancing it, or...?
Both. We refinanced and then we sold. So we bought it for about $7,500 a door. It was $699,000. One of the mistakes we made is we dramatically underestimated the renovation costs. So when you buy a 1970s property that's been neglected for a decade and a half, when you peel off the layers, you find more bad layers.
What was the rental cost per unit then?
It ended up being about 7,500 units. We bought it for 699. We put about 699 into it.
Jake's loving you even more. Jake is loving you even more, bro.
Once we had it staged, so when we bought it, it was collecting $8,000 a month in revenue. When we sold it, it was collecting like $41,000-$42,000 a month in revenue. So, I mean,
I'm surprised it wasn't higher.
Yeah, well, it's a lower income area. Another area I wouldn't buy in. I wouldn't buy it there anymore. Not high crime, fortunately, just low income.
Okay.
But when did you sell this? What year did you sell it at?
We sold that in early 2016, and we sold it for 1.75. So,
thinking you were like 60, 70 a month on the thing. So I was like, wow, that's going to be awesome. But
it was a lower income area. Yeah, so you can only get the rent so high. Sure. That was one of the lessons is, we don't buy in those low income areas. We don't buy that heavy distressed property. And now we know how to properly estimate rehab. So.
Gotcha. Wow. Any other lessons you learned? As far as raising money, as far as, time it takes to do these kinds of things. Refinancing, give us the lowdown of any other mistakes you learned on this.
We'll start with raising money since that tends to be most people's concern these days. If I was, getting started and I'm raising money for a deal, if I needed $1 million, I would go raise $1.5 million. And what I mean is $1.5 million in commitments, because especially on your first deal, not everyone's going to follow through, right? Grandma's going to get sick and needs a new kidney, and there's the medical bills, or, I forgot, I bought a condo on the beach. I'm sorry, I don't have the money anymore. Or, the money was going to come from me selling my condo on the beach, and it fell out of escrow, right? So get a lot more in soft commitments than you actually need. As you get seasoned both with your track record and with your investors, that overage can come down a lot more. But in the mm-hmm. beginning, definitely raise a lot more than you need. And ask those questions. Just say, hey, okay, we're probably gonna need to fund in about a month. Is there anything that could make it so you might not have that money available? So ask that extra question. That was a mistake I made on my first one, is I didn't vet some of my investors. I had two people who said they were gonna invest $400,000 each. One of the guy never had it and eventually declared bankruptcy. And then the other guy, I did a poor job of finding out what his expectations were. He wanted to be a full-on partner. And I'm like, no, that's not what we're doing here. So that was some of the lessons that I learned on raising money. And then also on renovation, it just sounds so stupid in retrospect, but we basically went through and we'd flipped houses and stuff. So went through and said, okay, this unit, this will take $5,000. This will take $6,000. This will take $7,000. No, walk through with your contractors and competing contractors. I usually do three. So if I'm looking at doing roofs, I will show up with three roof guys. It's friendly, but they all know what they're there for. And guys, here's the goal we want. you know, I get three bids on the roof. So by the time that I'm closing a deal or generally going hard or wrapping up due diligence, I have actual cost of what it's going to be to fix stuff versus just an kind of my own estimate or whatever. And then of course we factor in contingency on top of that. So that's a few things. I could go on for an entire podcast on lessons from that one.
Quick review of what you just said. He just said he brings the contractors there at the same time. Guys, guess what? If they know there's going to be competing bids, not that if you put everybody there at the same time, they're going to be, you know, sharpening their pencils. So I think that's a great tip and everyone should, you know, everyone always says get three bids, but man, you put them there at the moment. Yeah. That's really great. It's
just like showing an apartment, Jake, and having an open house for an apartment
and making
the scarcity. As soon as there's a scarcity trigger in sales, people know, you have to sharpen your pencil, like you said. Andrew, let's keep going with the mistakes because Jake and I have made a ton of them and we like to focus on mistakes because I just think that's what people are always afraid of. What can I, what can I stay away from? You said it's a bad area. The raising the money, the renovation costs. Anything else come into mind on this deal?
Yeah. So the bad area, that's one. So that gets into crime. So now what we do is, in true due diligence, we talk to the police department. We go, we visit the beat officers and all of that. But one of the things we screen for now is we'll go to like Trulia and there's a bunch of other sites, Crime Mapper, there's tons of them now, and just look and pull it up. And if it's anything but fully safe, we're done. We're just not going there. The one exception would be, if you pull up on Trulia, it's the darker blue it is, the higher the crime. And I guess that's because maybe there's more cops there. I don't know why it's blue. To me, it should be red, because it's more dangerous. But yeah, exactly. But so if the whole neighborhood's blue, you can't change that. You can't fix that. So we run away. Sometimes what you'll see though is the neighborhood is green and just the property you're looking at is blue. That's something you can fix. That's an opportunity because that means that property is badly managed. But other than that, if there's any hint of crime, we're out. We're just not going to touch it because you cannot bring your property above the neighborhood. The other thing is the income. So we look now for median incomes, and this would change depending on your market and the type of properties you're buying. But we want our median income to be at least $35,000 or higher, because as you the further below that number you go, number one, the headache factor dramatically goes up. And number one, that's especially in urban areas, that includes crime. But even if you're not in urban areas, that's generally higher evictions, higher delinquency, people who, if they get a flat tire, they can't make rent that month, right? So it's just the management and the headaches tend to go up. And then also, we're towards the end somewhere of a cycle, right? We're certainly not at the beginning. And so there's going to be a soft patch at some point. We want our rents to be affordable to a majority of the population, right? So if you're buying an apartment in an area where the median income is $20,000 and your rent's going to be $700 or $800 a month, that's not affordable to those people, right? So affordability is roughly, depending on who you're talking to, defined as 30% or less of someone's income is going to rent. So if I'm going to buy a property and let's say their current rent's $750 and I'm going to get it up to $1,000, well, 1,000 times 12 is 12,000. And to make roughly a third of someone's income to be 12,000, they need to be making 35,000, right? So that's where that number comes from. And we found that as long as we stay above that, we generally have a really good pool of potential renters for those C+ to B properties that we're doing.
That's great. So you had a potential Nicolas Cage on your first property. How long did it take you to get your second property after that first one?
You know what? The next one was probably only 6 months after we closed. Might have been a little bit less. Same broker. And that one turned into a home run and we still own it today.
So. Jake, this is the same path that we take and a lot of other guys take. Our first deal was, I think it was probably almost as bad as yours, but 3 months later we got our second deal. So how did you find that second deal?
The same broker that we purchased the first one from brought it to us. He knew we performed. He knew we did what we said, said we were going to do. And it's all the little things. If you say you're going to call a broker back on Thursday, call him back on Thursday. And don't be a pain in the butt to work with. So he brought the second one to us. It was two guys who, you know, owned it together. We're starting to have disagreements on how it should be run and managed, and that showed in the operations. It was, you know, maybe 80% occupied. It wasn't terrible, but it was really well located, and the pricing was really good. And he brought it to us, and I looked at. And now at this point, after trying to do the first syndication all by myself, I had brought on two partners to help spread the load and spread the ability to raise money. And we looked at that deal and said, wow, this actually looks really good. We bought it. It was 94 units for $1.3 million. Some of it was built in the 70s and the mid 80s. And we've refinanced that and given returned like 160 or 70% of the equity, and still own it today. And it runs like a champ.
Is it in the Macon area also?
That one is also in Macon, yeah.
Wow. So you got two under your belt. You're still flipping houses at this point, or did you just give that up?
No. By the time we got that one, we said we're done with single family houses.
Wow. So
why?
What's that?
Why?
Well, so, you know, flipping single family houses, it can be great money, but it's just another job, right? You're only as good as that deal. The minute you sell that deal and deposit the check in the bank, hopefully, you've got no income coming in, right? But you buy 92 units, you reposition it, you do a good job. Now you've got income coming in for 5 years or 10 years or however long you underwrote that with your investors, and you can build a true business out of it with residual income. I mean, you can, people build amazing businesses flipping houses too. But for me, multifamily, number one, the demographic trends really support it. And then number two, it's, you know, what in GoBundance we call horizontal income, or, you know, or income that just keeps showing up every month. So
let me ask you, how did you end up going at after that second deal? You said to yourself, I just want to keep scaling. Did you keep syndicating deals? Did you continue to invest in Macon, or are you looking at other markets?
We expanded out to other markets, so Atlanta proper, and then DFW and Houston. I actually used to live in Texas, so I know those markets fairly well. So we expanded out there. At this point, let's see, we're currently working on our 14th syndication. The average deal size across all of them has been 140 units. And so, yeah, every deal we've done has been, I take that back. There was one that wasn't syndicated. It was just a small group of investors. But other than that, every deal has been syndicated.
And what are your parameters? What are you looking for as returns, debt coverage ratios, cap rates? What is your normal, you know, target?
As a value add investor, we're generally not really looking at going in cap rates, because, you know, you might have a situation where, I mean, if there's a lot of upside to something, and there's always exceptions, the going in cap rate might look silly. It might be 4 or 5%, but, you know, 2 years down the road, you're going to have it at a 12, right? And we've actually done that recently. So I'm looking for, you know, 1980 or newer, 100 units on up, markets with above average, and average being the U.S., so above average population growth and job growth, right? So in the last 10-year period, I think the U.S. population growth was 9.7%. The last market we bought in, it was 29%, right? So clearly growing faster than the rest of the country. Same thing with job growth, whatever the, you know, bounces around, but whatever the median job growth is for the country, we want to buy in a market where it's well above that. And so 1980 or newer, we don't buy in flood zones. And again, I mentioned low crime, the median income, the population growth, job growth. You know, and at this point in the cycle, we're also looking for economic drivers that tend to be recession resistant. So we like a military component. We don't do just military towns. We don't want to rely on any one thing, but a military component is pretty stable these days. We really like higher education, so universities. Large medical centers, basically industries and job creators that, whenever a recession comes, are the least likely to be affected.
So what markets are you targeting right now? Where have you bought your last few deals in?
We like the Southeast in general. Atlanta's good, but it's pretty hot and competitive, and I'd say overheated in some submarkets. There's a lot of good secondary and tertiary markets. So we've purchased in Valdosta, Georgia recently. We've purchased a phenomenal deal in Panama City Beach, Florida, in the Panhandle. Pensacola is good. We've picked up some really good property in the Augusta area of Georgia. Athens is doing really well. We don't own anything there yet. Columbia, South Carolina is another market we like. A lot of state government jobs there, so it's it doesn't boom like Atlanta or DFW, but it's just solid, steady, consistent. Savannah's doing fairly well with the ports. Charleston, South Carolina is really good. Pretty competitive, but also a good market. Tampa and Orlando are great too. So
let me ask you, when you go in there, how do you vet your property management company? Because this is all third party by management, correct?
Correct. So we actually now use the same property management company for all of our entire portfolio, which gives us a lot of leverage in a lot of different ways. But when we first went into the market and we bought our first asset there, what we did is I talked to brokers property brokers, insurance brokers, and the lenders, and said, hey, if you were buying this asset or this type of asset, who would you recommend to run this thing the best? And I got the top two or three names from each one of those people. And what I was looking for is I want to see who kept showing up over and over again. And I did. I got like two or three that almost everybody would recommend. Talked to those, went out, interviewed them in person, and then chose one. And they've been fantastic.
So what do you look for? What do you look for? What are the qualities you look for in a property management company?
I want them to be small enough where I have the owner of the company's cell phone number, but big enough that they have the efficiencies of scale. So what that meant to me is when we first hired our company, they had 3,000 units. Now they've got like 24,000. They've grown, but they had 3,000 units. I also want them to specialize in my type of asset. So the company we hired specializes in C+ to A-. They don't do trophy assets. They're not in Buckhead, managing high-rise towers or anything like that. They don't do high crime. They don't do D. They specialize. Their core is B properties, and that's what our core competency is. So we want someone who matches that well. Also, they don't own properties. They only third-party manage. So you don't have to worry about, well, if they own one 2 blocks away, are they going to send all the good tenants over there? Mm-hmm. Also, I'm just looking for somebody that has a really good reputation around town, which is how I found them in the first place. And that I get the sense that they want to maintain that reputation. And so that means if they screw up my property, they're going to put a black mark on their reputation. It's a pretty small world, and that's going to hurt them. So I want to make sure there's someone that is motivated to not do that.
Okay, so I got a question here. I think this is a great opportunity if you want to pay it forward to the listeners and the property manager. It sounds like they've done a good job. You want to give them a shout out so that other folks could, network with this company, or is that something you don't feel comfortable doing?
Sure. It's Strategic Management Partners. They're fantastic. They generally speaking aren't accepting new clients now. They've gotten to kind of the size they want. That's part of
you
why
you own them.
but no, they've done an amazing job and they're phenomenal. Like I said, last time I talked with the owners, they weren't accepting new clients, but that's who they are.
Cool.
How has your investment strategy changed over the last 5 years from when you started till now?
We're a little bit more defensive now, meaning the number one thing we look at now is what's the potential downside? And if we're comfortable with that, then we say, okay, what's the potential upside? And then also, we're 4 or 5 years ago, we were trying to buy in, in Inner Loop Atlanta or in the really close in suburbs, because we felt like Atlanta was going to boom. Whereas now we're more like, kind of like I was talking about Valdosta, right? There it's, eds, meds, and military stuff that's going to do well pretty much no matter what. Yeah, I mean, not that I don't see a huge crash coming. My crystal ball is cracked like everybody else's, so I can't say exactly what's going to happen. Right now, everything looks great. The long-term fundamentals are there, but we're kind of late in the game. So instead of saying, "All right, we're going to we think this area is just going to boom," we're looking for that, but we're also looking for a little bit heavier weight on the defensive strategy, right? Because the number one thing you want to do is don't lose money. That's the number one rule. And then number two is try to make money. Actually, Warren Buffett would say number two is refer to number one. So that's how it's changed a little bit. And also we're looking for Okay, so take Panama City, Florida, for example, right? There's a company there called Eastern Shipbuilding. They just won the contract to build the entire fleet of destroyers for the U.S. Navy. It's going to take them 10 years, billions of dollars, and they're bringing in 2,000 really high, you know, really highly skilled, well-paid people to do that. That is not going to change no matter what the economy is doing. And we have benefited already just from that announcement and people coming in. And, you know, we want to be in areas like that where they are booming, you know, stories that might be under the radar that are going to get, you're not going to see that on the national media.
Andrew, that's a great analogy because every one white collar worker is going to bring an additional 3 to 4 blue collar workers. So you've got the nail salons, the delis, you need the pizzerias, Jake. You know what I'm saying? You need all that kind of stuff.
We need pizzeria in Knoxville. You guys want an opportunity? Start a freaking pizzeria with good pizza in Knoxville next to my house, and I will buy from you.
Hey, you know what I like to say? Every pizza is a personal pizza if you try hard enough and believe in yourself.
Absolutely.
Oh man, you guys are killing me. How have you guys scaled your business? I mean, how have you gotten all the employees? And, you know, these last 5 years, you've gotten a lot of units under your belt. How's that progressed?
So I've got a fantastic office manager that we converted two of the rooms in our house to offices, and so I've got my wife is a full time partner, and then we've got a really good office manager that helps us out with a lot of, you know, admin and investor relations and things like that, making sure our K-1s are all lined up properly. And you know, for the properties themselves, like I said, SMP handles all the day to day management, and you know, my real role is asset manager, so I'm managing them. And they also have renovation coordinators that help me coordinate the renovations. So most we don't have a lot of, and then I have other principals too. So I've got three other principals that have been in real estate for decades. They contribute, you know, their knowledge and also bring in additional investors. And so we've got the four of us as principals. And then really everybody else is third party. We found that works out really well because you're not committed to overhead. And we won't ever be in a position where we have to try to do a deal just to feed the machine. You know, when you stay lean, you can do deals because it's a good deal, not because you have to.
Mm-hmm.
Quick question. Since we don't syndicate deals and we've just kind of, we do this refi and roll strategy, how much of your time, because we've considered syndicating before, is taken up with investor relations and investor calls, et cetera? How much of that, or is that more of the admin person? How does that work in your office?
Yeah, it's actually, in the beginning, it definitely would be more, but candidly now, It very little. You know, our office manager does handle the paperwork because when you syndicate and someone invests, there's subscription agreements and all that kind of thing. You know, I do all of the quarterly reporting. And what I've found is if you are transparent and over-communicate and communicate well and send out the checks every quarter, no one's going to bother you. I mean, because, you know, you're doing a job. You're doing your job. You're doing a great job. What causes a lot of time requirements for investors is, number one, if your properties aren't performing, and then number two, if you're not communicating well, right? Because in the absence of communication, it's human nature to assume the worst or assume something bad or something undesirable is happening. So be transparent and over communicate, and then, you know, send out the checks. And candidly, it's a great partnership. I call it appreciative money, right? People, you know, maybe doctors or who make really good salaries, or someone has a good 401k, they invest $100,000. They appreciate what you're doing to get them a good return that they otherwise probably wouldn't be able to get.
I agree with that. Before we get to the short answer question, I wanted to ask you, what is your favorite part of the business?
So here's a story. We bought a property one time, and this one was in a bit of a rougher area. And I'm walking through, and this was in a demographic. We'll just say I stuck out like a sore thumb. And so I'm walking through, and this lady runs up to me, and she goes, "Are you the owner?" And, you know,
we just had that happen to us a couple of weeks ago, man. I'm sorry. Funniest thing. I was like, "No, there's problems with this deal." All right.
And I'm always a little hesitant. Like, why are you asking? You know. But no. So as well, so whenever someone, and this is actually this, I would recommend some version of this to anybody, is I say, well, I work for the owners because the owners are my investors, right? And I work for them. They're the true owners. So that's what I tell them. I said, well, I work for the owners. What, you know, how can I help you? And she goes, and she puts up her hand. She goes, give me a high five. I'm like, okay, cool. You know, like that. This one's heading in the right direction, I think. And like, well, hey, so what's going on? She says, oh man, we're so glad you guys are in here. And you know, this place used to be, you know, kind of rough, and I didn't really feel safe living here. And, you know, now my husband and my kids, you know, we love it. You guys have made all these improvements, and, you know, we really appreciate you. No one else has come in here for so long, and it's so much better. She's like, do you like barbecue? I'm like, well, I mean, you know, of course I do. Oh, well, you know, next time you're out, we'll make you barbecue and come on in and all that. And, you know, so I love that feeling.
And then you said, by the way, I kind of am the owner now.
No. You know, and so it's really fun to improve the communities, and maybe that comes from the flipping of taking a property that is a little bit unloved or nowhere near its potential, and you have a vision for it, and you pull a team together and you execute that vision, and then you go back on the property like, wow, this place looks great, and the residents are happy, and we're making great returns for our investors and for us, and you know, you can make good money while doing good, and it's a good way to do it.
Andrew, Jake is referencing the story about 3.5-4 weeks ago, the mom and pop property. I'm down in Tennessee with our other partner. There's three of us and a property manager going on. I think out of all the properties, only one didn't do this. Everyone else, they'd come on and say, are you guys the owners? We have clipboards and everything.
This wasn't our deal. This was a deal we're looking to buy.
And the property manager was like the worst. He's like,
he was dodging and ducking, man. Look at the boxer, right? No, I don't know. Get away from me, man.
It was the funniest thing in the world. I'm like, dude, this place is great. This is the mom and pop king right here, bro.
That probably means they haven't worked on a maintenance work order in a long time, if that's what's happening.
And it just stinks because there's not much you got to do for customer service on a 20-unit property, bro. Go fix the sink. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't take that much. They're not asking for that much. You know what I mean? It's like it kills me. I totally agree with it. Anyway, Mr. Senziano, go ahead with the shorts,
baby. This is what I'm trying to find out, because very smart guy here. I'm sure he's got some tricks up his sleeve. So what are some things that you're doing to add value and additional revenue? Are you doing like the trash valets, or do you have any tricks that, you know, you're like, you know, I don't know if everyone's doing this, but we're doing it and executing it well?
Yeah, I mean, this product's probably going to be boring, but a lot of times the good money is in boring stuff. I mean, it's the typical faux wood vinyl flooring. We're usually upgrading lighting and hardware fixtures. So yeah, I love when I walk into a kitchen and I see one of those industrial like neon, you know, rectangular bulbs that should be in a garage and it's in the kitchen. You know, we'll change that to something nice and brushed nickel. We'll do things like add dog parks. Those are incredibly popular right now. Certain properties will do fitness centers if we think they'll actually be used. We like to put in bright colored large playgrounds. We've had a lot because not only is that adding an amenity, it's eye catching, right? I'm not a fan of the brown and green playgrounds that kind of like fade into the background. I'm talking bright yellow,
blue, red, blue,
orange, red. Yeah. And then what we do is
Google playgrounds.
Yeah. There you go. Google. I like that. I'm gonna borrow that. I'll give you credit the first two times, then I'm going to steal it. No. So Google playgrounds, and then, you know, you put nice mulch and surround them with railroad ties. And then we put a bench for the parents to sit on and cover it. So they're not, you know, we're talking Georgia and Florida, so no one wants to sit in the sun. So put a gazebo or something. We always add grilling stations, because that's really inexpensive. And especially in the South, people love their barbecues. That's all right. And we make sure the pools are nice. We typically put in new furniture, make, you know, colorful furniture, brighten it up. We might resurface the deck or something. And then we also always spend a lot of money on landscaping and signage. That is your sign, your monument sign, is the first impression people get. And you want to make sure that people drive by, see that sign and go, wow, I hope I can live there. And then that draws them in. Same with the landscaping. Landscaping is some of the best money you'll ever spend. And so that's, you know, that's typically what we focus on.
I'm a piggyback on this. Signage, landscaping, and website. Right. Yes. Now, those are the first impressions, man. No, you got to hit it from the time they're marketing, they check you out online, then they're looking at that sign, Then they're looking at the Google Playground and dog park. You got to, that is the bare minimum right now to get a decent renter. You got to tee that stuff up first before they even get to his fancy, you know, vinyl flooring that he's putting in there, because you know the folks are loving that.
So
that
let's go one step further. It's video.
Oh, here we go. What do you got?
You gotta get the video in there, bro. You gotta get video, not just pictures. You gotta show what your property is all about. That's what I think.
Get the video on the website for the GDAD.
Yeah.
So, all right. Love to ask people this. What is your best habit for success? You've done really well, I'm sure, in school, had a nice corporate job. Now you're a self-made man. What is something that you do on a daily, weekly basis that has led to your success?
Yeah, I would say the biggest factor is just relentless persistence. Just saying my wife and I, we are going to do this until we succeed at it. Once we succeed on it, if we don't like it, fine, we can quit then. But we commit and we are relentlessly persistent to doing that. As far as daily habits go, you know, one thing I do every night is I plan the next day exactly what I'm going, you know, what I'm going to do. So I each night I look at I use Google Calendars. Everything we're doing, you know, personal, business, family, whatever, it's all on Google Calendar. My wife and I share the calendars. So I look at the calendar. I use a great app called Todoist to manage all my projects and tasks and things that I've delegated. So I look at the calendar. I look at Todoist, put those things together, and then make the plan for the next day. So that when I wake up in the morning, the day is our, like, I don't have to figure
follow
out.
Follow the yellow brick road.
Yeah. It's the path is laid out. So when I've got, you know, I'm well rested, and that's another, I make sure I get as much sleep as I need. Don't cut on sleep. That affects your health. It affects your productivity. It affects your happiness, your relationships, everything. So I make sure I get the sleep that I need. And then when I wake up in the morning, you know, the plan's already laid out. Some days things happen and that gets disrupted, but you know, you just know that's going to happen. But most days, you know, generally goes to plan. You know, three, four days a week, I make sure I go get a good workout in, to rejuvenate, refresh, stay, you know, hopefully stay healthy. But those are some of the routine habits that I really stick to that feel like have made a difference.
And I think the most important thing that you said, and the thing that really helped Gino and I out in the beginning was, and I think it's really the best thing that we've done, is we didn't quit. Because you mentioned before, 6 months to get in your deal. It took us much longer than that. So the bottom line is, if you want to get in this business and you want to leave your job for more freedom, because that's really what I think we're all doing here. This is time, family, financial, whatever kind of, you know, fitness freedom you just touched on, right? You got to put the time in. It's not going to happen overnight. So it's just, you know, if you're really going to do it, don't quit. I think it's oversimplified, cliche, but there's a lot of truth to it.
Yep. So,
what should you have done differently when starting out?
I would not have bought a heavily distressed C-minus asset.
Come on, man, that's awesome.
If I could start off differently, I would have gone and bought a B asset for a couple of reasons. Number one, I've found that the returns, if you do it right, are just as good with lower risk and lower headache. And then in the last few years, well-located B properties in particular have really appreciated, both in terms of value and rent. So I just, you know, I would have started in the B properties and continued there versus start in the hard Cs.
What about a book recommendation?
You know, I could give a couple for mechanics and learning about multifamily and markets and all that. I would give three. David Green's long distance real estate investing, because that's a hurdle for a lot of people, is, oh my gosh, I can't invest out of my own city. Combine that with Dave Lindahl's multifamily millions and emerging markets. Those three will form a great base for getting into apartments. And then in addition to that, it's an old one, but it's Human Nature Doesn't Change. It's How to Win Friends and Influence People. Because, yeah, there's a lot of numbers involved, but every aspect you're dealing with people. The brokers are people. Your lenders are people. Your property management, people. Every aspect of it is relationships. And without good relationships, you're not going to succeed.
What would Kim Taylor say the other day, Gino? You heard it a million times. People do business with the ones they know, like, and trust. Is that what she said?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know Kim. She's great.
Yeah. What project are you excited about right now?
Well, we just got a, I can't really talk about it, but we just got an LOI accepted on another, Monday on a fantastic deal that checks every box. So really excited about that one. And yeah, so that as far as business wise, that's got me pretty excited.
So if people want to find out more about you and the deals that you're doing, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
You know, I'm on LinkedIn and Bigger Pockets, but that's really just kind of an easy way to connect. If you really actually want to have a conversation, where, you know, it's Vantage Point Acquisitions. The website for that is just vpacq.com. There's a contact us form on there. Just submit your information. That goes directly to my email inbox, and I will get back to you as quick as I can.
Gino, I think you should invite him to our live event in Nashville.
Andrew, would you like to come to a live event in Nashville?
Yeah, that sounds fun. I like Nashville.
It's a great market. October 6th and 7th in Nashville. We got a lot of your GoBros out there. Bruce Peterson's coming out. Devin Elder's going to be there.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Trying to recruit a lot of other guys. Kim Terrell is actually – she's actually presenting out there, so – we picked Nashville because it's just a beautiful market. It's a beautiful city. A lot of stuff going on. We have an Ed Sheeran concert going on that night over there. Bruno Mars is on. So it's really, really in high demand. I mean, like you said, you look at a market and see what's going on. I mean, Nashville, there's 4 and 5 caps because everyone's moving there. I mean, yeah. Moving there, people are moving there. So, yeah, we'd love to have you there. It's going to be a good time. We're going to have a great time.
Oh, thanks. Appreciate it.
Gino, anything else for your fellow GoBro here?
Anything else? Just want to thank him for sharing the story. I think, Andrew, just keep talking about those mistakes because I think people want to hear the mistakes. And I think the only thing you may have did wrong in the first deal, maybe 92 units might have been a little too big. I don't think the asset type was hard. I think 92 units, people are like, I can't do that. We started with a smaller asset, and we probably brought sort of the same type of problems that you had. Jake refers to it as a crack den. But, I mean, you know it was a great learning experience. I just thank you for being on, for sharing your story, and, you know, wish you a lot of luck in the future.
Oh, you're welcome. It was great talking with you guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew.
We trust that you enjoy the Wheelbarrow Profits podcast. Visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. See you next time when Jake and Gino share more of their investing secrets with you.